Hi, everyone. My name is Josh Nason. This is Josh Nason's Punch-Out here on WrestlingObserver.com. Back once again with a returning guest coming back for his third appearance all time on JNPO, that being author Guy Evans. Guy is back to talk about his new book, Beyond Nitro, which came out earlier this year and is a sequel to the very popular Nitro book, which talked about in detail the rise and fall and existence of WCW. And Beyond Nitro, as you might imagine by the title, takes it beyond that book. It's a much different book, and Guy and I get into that conversation, the structure of it, the different interviews, and some of the interesting financial details you'll get out of the book, some new revelations about WCW's accounting, and essentially kind of really what killed the company from within, as well as WWE actually paid more for WCW than you might think. We talk about that. Some fascinating stories from in the book. It's really good. So we chat about that. And also the brand new announced Kickstarter for a 3-part Hulk Hogan series called The Hulk Hogan Story that Guy is looking to raise some money for and some awareness. So we talk about that. His plans to write The Hulk Hogan Story, a biographical trilogy. Easy for me to say. So we chat about Beyond Nitro. We chat about a little bit about the Nitro book as well. And also about the Hulk Hogan trilogy he hopes to put out in the next couple of years. All that and more await Josh Nason's Punch-Out with Guy Evans coming up right about now. Returning for the third time on this podcast in its long illustrious history is an author. He has written a slew of books, and of course I had his info up here. I'm gonna go all this by memory because I can't find my tabs. I have so many tabs open. Of course, yeah. Nitro, the first book, two books with David Penzer, Sitting Ringside Volume 1 and 2, Grateful with Eric Bischoff, and his brand new book, Beyond Nitro. Yes, Beyond Nitro, a sequel to the first book, Nitro, a much different type of book. And we're going to talk about that, Hulk Hogan, and all kinds of other stuff with the very popular returning Guy Evans. Guy, welcome back.
Oh, thank you, Josh. Always great to be with you, and I appreciate the invite.
Yeah, this is fun. We always have good conversations. Last time we talked was last summer, actually, last June, I believe, when we were talking about the Volume 1 of Sitting Ringside. Of course, Volume 2 has come out since then. Of course, the Nitro book has come out since then. You were on Who Killed WCW? You know, again, we talked about you being a major media star and such back then and everything. But yeah, I mean, you've a lot of things to admire about you. One is that you always stay busy. You have this, I think last time we talked, I had not listened back. You were teasing a new book and you said it was with material that was very familiar to you. And lo and behold, it was a sequel to Nitro.
Yes, that's right. And I appreciate the kind words, Josh, you know, and it's because of people like you having me on over the years that I've been able to spread the word about all of these projects. So I very much appreciate that. But you're right in terms of the last time that we spoke. I think we were coming up on announcing a new project, which ultimately became Beyond Nitro. And as you alluded to in the introduction, it's a different kind of book than the first book. The structure is such that you're looking at sort of standalone chapters, almost, you know, self-contained stories, if you will. And the book is divided into three parts. So the first part contains all of these, you know, untold stories related to people who had some kind of a unique connection to WCW. And that section includes input from a lot of people that haven't spoke on the record previously, someone like a Keith Mitchell, for example, who obviously a lot of people listening to this will be very familiar of his work, not only with WCW, but World Class, TNA, AEW, of course, up until a few years ago. So that's the first section of the book, Untold Stories. And then the second section, it's called Where the Big Boys Played. And this is where I'm sort of looking back retrospectively on a lot of facets of the WCW story, which I think have often escaped introspection over the years, such as the influence of the WCW video games and the relationship between WCW and THQ, and how I think that not only strengthened the fandom of a lot of existing fans at that time, but also brought, untold numbers of new people to the genre as well. There's a really long chapter all about WCW's Southern lineage, which I think manifested itself in this kind of continual, conflict really that was at the heart of a lot of its programming, where you had, of course, the more so the traditionalists, if you like, the Ric Flair, the Dusty Rhodes, and so forth, battling it out, both behind the camera and also in front of the camera for position with the likes of Hall, Nash, and Hogan. And so there's a great chapter all about the lineage of the company historically and how that played out. But the there's a couple of chapters which I'm most excited about in that particular section, which pertain to WCW's financial performance as an entity under Turner. And this is something that I've had a lot of questions about over the years, because going back to that first book, if you notice, I talk a lot about overall revenues and overall expenses and things of that nature. But I think people wanted even more detail about that. So I essentially take you through on a line item by line item basis for every year of the Nitro era, and actually prior to that, what was recorded on the books internally at TBS in terms of what WCW was credited as generating, and equally what it was credited as in terms of the expense side of the ledger. And then the final part of the book, which is called A Wrestling Odyssey, is looking at a lot of the changes that have occurred in the wrestling business post the days of WCW, and perhaps how WCW's legacy has influenced all of those things. So we're talking about nearly a 700-page book this time. It's actually, I think, 10 or 15% longer than the original book. I'm very proud about it, very proud of it. I've been so taken aback and pleased at the reception. And, there's obviously a lot of work that's gone into it, over 100 new interviews. Hundreds of internal company documents have informed this book. So, if you enjoyed, the Nitro book, then I think this one, in many, many ways, is truly going beyond that. Not only in its structure, its scope, but I think, I'd like to think that everything is even more elevated than the first book. So please check it out.
Yeah, so I want to get into some of those financials and so on, and some of the other aspects of the book, which I'm still making my way through. I was going to mention it's a healthy read. Like, it is lengthy and it's good. I mean, it's perfect for the, we're entering fall and the winter. I mean, people want to go outside, especially in, like, northeast cold place, to just sit and read some of these very meaty chapters. I want to go back to the original Nitro, because someone may be listening to this that may have not read the original or what have you. But essentially, it came out about 6 years ago, give or take. And it right?
Yeah, 6, 7, somewhere in there, yeah.
Something like that. Six, seven. That's what the kids say these days, right? Six, seven. At least my 8-year-old does. Yes. But that book was really about the rise and fall of Nitro, and done in a way that is so much different than, like, other books that have came out. Brian Alvarez wrote his book and so on. This was more of a, and one of the reasons it stood out to me so much, and when we talked about this, and people can go back and listen to the podcast if they choose, it was, again, sourced by, you're talking to, like, hundreds and hundreds of different people, and not just the frontliners, but the people behind the scenes and the people that really got into the nitty-gritty of different details, and people that initially aren't the sexiest people to talk to in terms of, like, for a podcast, right? But in terms of, like, understanding this is what happened and this is why it happened, and again, for so many different perspectives, that's what the original book was really so great at. And kind of going to this book, that first one, as we were alluding to, it's a different structure. And this one, I think, is also a different structure. I would suggest having people read the first one, because it's just going to provide that big foundation for this, because this is also some of the payoffs of some of the things that you talked about. Again, having those relationships, those details you mentioned, new interviews and things like that. So when it came to this one, when did you first decide, okay, I'm going to do this? Was it kind of as you got through the first one, was it always in the back of your head? Or as time kind of went on, were you just like, you happen to talk to someone, or you look at some notes, or how did the second one come about?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think I always knew in the back of my head that this could very easily be a series of books based on just the sheer amount of material that I had, even back in 2018. And of course, you have to stop somewhere. I figured after 600 pages that first time around, that was probably about enough. But I always knew that there was the potential to do at least one more book, and perhaps even more than that. And that was only strengthened, I think, by the reception that I received to that initial book coming out, which I think, as we've talked about previously, completely took me by surprise, truly. I thought it would be something that maybe made a splash for a week or two and people would say that was a decent read. Never did I imagine what it was going to turn into. So once I started to see that play out, obviously began doing some rudimentary, planning and research, actually as far back as 2019, believe it or not. And the first interview that I conducted for this book was in May of 2020, which seems like a complete lifetime away now. It was right at the beginning of the whole COVID era and so forth, when everyone was at home. And so I started to interview some people and put this thing together, slowly but surely. But I think one of the things that's happened in this intervening period is, not only have I been able to strengthen my relationships with a lot of people that were very integral to that first book, but equally, now that that book is out there and people have had time to digest it, of course, I've been introduced and recommended to a whole host of other people that I didn't have time or the scope, I should say, to speak to the first time around. And what that has led to is, the gathering of even more, data, information, evidence to support some of the things that were in the first book. You talked about the financial element to the story. I had a significant portion of the information that I currently have back in 2018, but since that time, I've been able to get my hands on even more. And so, I've seen sort of this debate sort of playing out over the last few years. Even to this day, it's amazing how these things still become discussion items where people look back on WCW, and of course, a key element of that is looking at how profitable the company was, or perhaps how not profitable it was at times. And I've sort of observed this conflict that's played out over time, where you have people that may sort of rely on contemporaneous media reporting and some things that have come out in legal disclosures and so forth, and said, look, for this particular year, this is what WCW made, this is what WCW lost, and I'm going to use that as evidence to support my view. And then on the other side of that, you've had people who, and in a lot of cases, these are people who perhaps worked at WCW or worked at Turner, who said, wait a minute, you've got to take some of this stuff at least with a grain of salt, and that there is a need to investigate further. So being that, I am probably one of the very few people in the world to have access to all of this information and be and able to look at, the detailed profit and loss statements, to look at the balance sheet of WCW and how that changed over time, to look at a whole host of, private confidential communications that were going on between corporate and the wrestling division. I figured it would be worth exploring that and sort of breaking down to people why some of these things do indeed, I would say, have to be treated with a healthy dose of skepticism. And what I'd like to do, just so people don't think that we're sort of speaking in the abstract or speaking in generalities here, is actually cite one specific example to support what I'm saying. So, you may already know the answer to this, Josh, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Okay, so perhaps pretend that you haven't read this already. But if I was to ask you, Josh, about the year 1997, okay, which was, of course, the one year where, from beginning to end, Raw, or I should say Nitro, bested Raw in the ratings for the entire calendar year. Obviously, you have the NWO becoming this cultural phenomenon. You have these massive pay-per-views occurring during the course of that year, regardless of what we may think about them as wrestling fans, right? Like Dennis Rodman being in the ring. The fact is, these were, mass media events that were happening during that point in time. The Bash at the Beach show that year, obviously the Starrcade, '97 event with Hogan and Sting. So in many people's eyes, they may look at 1997 perhaps as being, if not the peak, very, very close to the peak, as it relates to WCW as a company. So if I was to ask you, how profitable was WCW in that particular year, in the year of 1997, would you have sort of a ballpark figure that you would suggest as to its profitability?
Let's see. I would say, I mean, wildly profitable, right? I mean, with all the pay-per-views and things like I would say in that era, I don't know, 50 million maybe, something like that.
Yeah, and I don't think that's an altogether insane estimate because, one figure that people may have in their mind, and this came from Eric Bischoff, incidentally, and this was recorded in his first autobiography, is the figure of 55 million. So that was Eric's understanding of how profitable WCW was in the year of 1998, right? So if we have that figure in mind, I don't think a guesstimate of somewhere in the region of 50 is crazy. Well, if you actually look at the books and you look at what TBS recorded as it relates to WCW's profitability, it was a figure, substantially less than that. It was $824,000, right? So they concluded for the year of 1997, yes, WCW, quote, made money and it made less than $1 million in profit, right? So how did they arrive at that figure? Well, I would suggest, and the book goes into this in more detail than we have time for, but several, let's say, questionable computations or calculations were utilized here. So if you look at the category of licensing, for example, TBS credited WCW with a little under $1.2 million in revenue, set against expenses of a little over $1.1 million in revenue. The net profit line that they calculated for WCW's licensing activities for the entire year. Now, keep in mind, this is NWO, this is Sting, and think about all of the licensing opportunities that could be branching off from all of that. The total profitability of its licensing activities, $49,000 for the year. So, in other words, WCW's official financial statement is indicating that the company earned literally, $942 a week in consideration of its total licensing efforts for the entire year. Now, you might say, well, how on earth could that be possible? Well, if you look into it, what you find is it wasn't until October of 97 that WCW actually had a company-specific licensing division. So prior to that, it actually entered into those kind of agreements under the auspices of something that was called Turner New Media Inc., right? So that kind of gives you an educated guess as to where some of those inflows may have been heading. And then there are a number of other aspects which really dampened WCW's earnings in the year of 1997. You look at, for example, the treatment of interest on WCW's books, which is an aspect of this story which I've noted, never comes up in any discussion of what we're talking about, is the idea that the company could be using. We've heard about things like intercompany allocations, but we've never heard about the company actually being used as a shield to transfer interest from one company to another, which of course was made possible by virtue of the fact that WCW was literally categorized within a category called Other, along with things like the Atlanta Braves, the CNN Airport Network. So what that meant was, under accounting rules, you were able to move around revenues and expenses within that category so long as, in consolidation, the category was reporting the accurate total revenues and expenses, right? And they were under no fiduciary responsibility to disclose the intricate workings of that. So, in other words, when you would look at, a financial statement for Turner Broadcasting System, and you would see a number relative to the category of other, that final number that's being calculated is likely accurate. But within that category, you have no idea, unless you have access to this kind of stuff, you have no idea as to how they arrived at that figure. So, 1997 interest, WCW. On its profit and loss statement, there's a figure of $6.79 million that it absorbed in interest charges from another division within that category. Okay. There's another $2.982 million, to be specific, in intercompany allocations. And this is documented intercompany allocations, the net balance of same, right? Where, they're using WCW once again as a way to absorb expenses that have been accrued by other divisions and other entities within that category. There are also these sort of nebulous commission type payments, which amount to a little over $3 million, which we go into as well. So We don't have time to go through all of those different factors. I'm just giving people kind of a flavor for that. But once again, if you were to look on face value and say, wow, the company only made $824,000, I guess it really wasn't running that well in the year of 1997. At one level of analysis, you could say that's true. But once you actually start digging into the data and the financial statements and evaluating these things again on a line item by line item basis, you find certain aspects which I think at the very least deserve a healthy dose of skepticism, as I said before. So, if you're interested in not only that year, but 98, 99, 2000, and so on, and perhaps we can get into some of that, I'm not sure. You'll probably read more detailed financial information about any wrestling company than you could ever possibly want. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, I would say, and I think I want to go over that from a higher level. So the thing I took away from that chapter, which I believe is chapter 13, if I remember right, is one, it's very detailed, I'll put it that way. I think, Brandon Thurston and Dave Meltzer and some would tip their hats, in terms of the amount of details that are in there, and especially some of the financial terms used. The story that I took away from it, kind of, initially what you talked about was, and this also kind of bleeds into chapter 14 in terms of Ted Turner and how he ran his organization. I think you paint a very interesting story about how about his acquisition of the MGM properties, and essentially in the situation in which he had to sell some assets back, and he was just this real fly by seat of his pants guy, writing up deals on the back of an envelope with accountants, just saying, what are we doing here? And how that this just figured out mentality kind of really seemed to take hold throughout the company, and that affected WCW in a lot of ways. And you go through in detail in terms of how kind of some of the things you were alluding to as far as how things were allocated, some things they were really kind of screwed out of when it came to in terms of rights fees or just certain ways that they were performing well, but the way it made it look, to your point earlier, made it look like they weren't doing well. And it was just this the zero sum with all these different companies. I believe that was a term used where all these different companies, essentially the anything that had to make these companies get to zero sum were sometimes deferred to other companies in ways that wasn't fair. And my key takeaway from that chapter, along with some things you mentioned, was just how WCW is really just unfairly treated in so many ways. And for so long it's been, this narrative of just it was pure incompetence from the start to the finish, and you can be arguing to the end and what have you. Creatively, you talk about that a little bit as well, but really, I mean, no one in the company was doing them any favors, especially when the creation of Thunder came around.
That's right. And I think, one thing that's important to note at this stage, and I always make sure that I do this, is to separate, even though these two things are related, WCW as a business from WCW as a television show, right? So nobody in their right mind could ever make the argument that once we get into, the latter half of 98, 99, I mean, the year 2000, we could probably spend 5 hours just cataloging the insanity in that year alone. No one could possibly make the argument that the quality of the programming was anywhere near what it was at its peak, right? So none of this is to discount from the fact that, yes, there were many, many horrible decisions made creatively, in terms of, the talent that was being utilized in key positions, some of the, disastrous initiatives that WCW found themselves in, trying desperately, at one stage to turn the picture around in a week. So, I just want to make note of that, sometimes more than one thing can be true. But in regards to what you're talking about, you're right in pointing out that this was a systemic issue, as it related to Turner Broadcasting. None of this was unique to WCW by any stretch of the imagination. You made note of the fact that they had this very peculiar corporate structure where there were certain divisions that were designated as zero-based companies, which meant that by the end of the reporting period, whether that be a financial quarter or a financial year, all of the expenses associated with those entities had to be parked somewhere else. And Turner Home Entertainment is a perfect example of that, right? As we talk about in the book, it is documented that up until a certain period of time, the revenues that were generated for WCW's pay-per-views were being recorded on the books of Turner Home Entertainment, but all of the expenses for Turner Home Entertainment were going somewhere else, including at times WCW. So, at the end of the year, if you didn't necessarily have insight into that, you may look at it on paper and say, "Wow, these guys in Turner Home Entertainment are killing it." But it's kind of easy to make a profit if all of your expenses disappear and you get credited for revenues
Right.
that you didn't really directly have a hand in. Another facet of this, which I think is quite fascinating as well, is the fact that they had this incentive structure that was all based around revenues, distinct from profits, right? So a lot of the bonuses that were doled out to key executives and so forth were based on revenue targets. So you can just imagine some of the infighting that obviously would have gone on. If you know that I'm going to be compensated greater if I can get some of these revenues on my books, you know, it doesn't take a genius to see how that could have played out and how institutionally WCW may have taken a back seat to other entities that were deemed as, you know, part of the long-term, you know, plan. So, you know, it's as Keith Mitchell says in the book, it's kind of a bowl of spaghetti to try to strip, you know, all of the dodgy accounting out and to come up with a true number of how profitable or how not profitable WCW was. You raised the issue of the license fee discussion, and I think this is an important point to note, and we can kind of you know, drive this home by talking about the creation of Thunder. So if you look at you know, in 1998, excuse me, if you look at the year of 1998 when Thunder started, and you look at what the financial picture was at that particular time, what you'll see is that WCW was given an increased allocation of 10.42 million in consideration of the new show. Now, this was inclusive of Nitro going to 3 hours, right? So Nitro expands to 3 hours, Thunder is created, and they're given an increase in their what TBS called their programming license fee of $10.42 million. Now, again, it's important to note that this was an allocation coming up from on high. This was not a formal split of the ad revenue. That never flowed to WCW in a predictable way, which means that the term rights fee is somewhat problematic, because if you look at it in a contemporaneous sense, when a company like WWE is entering into an agreement for their media rights, that figure that's being quoted, you know, pertains to sort of long-term predictable, you know, funds that can be planned against accordingly. That was a completely different picture as it related to WCW. So they were given this increased allocation, like I said, 10.42 million, but they had a rise in production costs of over 12 million, 12.48 million to be exact. So, in other words, in order to do this extra show and in order to expand Nitro to a third hour, even though there is an element of, you know, an economy of scale at play there, because you already have all of the staff and all of the wrestlers and all of the sets and so forth at the arena. So, to do another hour, it's not like doing another hour on another night in another city. But nonetheless, it still costs more money. So, by expanding Nitro, adding Thunder, their production costs went up by 12.48 million, but they only got an increased allocation of 10.42 million. So therefore, if someone was to make the argument that WCW expanded at the cost of its divisional bottom line, and this is saying nothing, by the way, of, you know, other increases, as we point out in the book, of, you know, added arena expenditures, obviously the additional talent that you would theoretically need to do that second primetime show. You know, you can make the case that they did it at the cost of its divisional bottom line, which then makes it problematic when we wind the clock, you know, forward a couple of years, and now WCW is being looked at in very different terms, not as programming, which historically was its function within that Turner Corporation, but now almost being evaluated as a standalone entity. And so, you know, if you were to look at the years where it starts losing money now, there was no discussion of, hey, well, let's go back in the past and try to work out, you know, if there was a formal split of the ad revenue or if they were being paid market value for their programming, what would the financial picture have looked like? And let's try to come up with a true accounting of how successful this company has been. So I think, unfortunately, what happened is, you know, due to both of the mergers, but particularly the second merger, all of a sudden, every division, including WCW, was being looked at under a different set of standards relative to what the understanding had been in the past. And, you know, what's quite interesting is prior to the book coming out, you know, I had a discussion with Eric Bischoff about this. You know, of course, he was the president of WCW during the very same time period that we're talking about. And, you know, Eric was unaware of a lot of this stuff that we're talking about in terms of, the treatment of interest on WCW's books and how they were, he had a sense of how things were being moved around, but he didn't know the particulars of it. Whether that's a case of, the wrestling people having one set of understanding of what was going on and the corporate people having another, that's something I think the readers will have to make up their own minds about. But I'm glad you raised the issue of Thunder, because that again is a very tangible example of how WCW's performance as a company was actually adversely affected by something that should have been a positive, at least financially, not necessarily from a programming standpoint, which was its expansion, but it actually, ended up getting shot in the foot because of that.
Yeah, the quote by Dick Cheatham stands out in that, talking about Turner as a whole is these guys. I'm paraphrasing. It was all about revenue, and these guys, if they could spend $10 in expenses to make an extra dollar in revenue, they would do it. The expenses in general were never concerned. It was just always revenue, revenue, revenue. And that's ultimately, again, that chapter, and also the it does a great job kind of explaining some of the dysfunction within. And then I do, before we move on to one thing I want to ask about with some of the non-business stuff, is you also in that chapter after called Goodwill Games, you talk about Ted Turner, and you also talk about really kind of reveal that for so long the narrative has been, well, WWE bought WCW for, I think, I can't remember, the total is like 4 million or something along those lines. But actually, there was a much larger, it was a much larger commitment in terms of money because of essentially buying advertising, correct?
Yes, so unfortunately, there's no way to really be brief about this. This may take us a while to sort through. And if you want to interject, then please do. I'll try to be as succinct as possible. But yes, this is a hugely important story as it relates to WCW, but also wrestling history more generally. The actual sale of WCW, or more accurately, a hand-picked collection of its assets to the WWF. So, the figure, the finalized figure that was reported on the WWF's financial disclosures was 4.155 million, and that represents a cash portion of the transaction, which was $2.5 million, and then the balance of that was reflective of additional costs that the company incurred in making the sale happen. And if you read in the book, you'll get an indication of what some of those things were. That included, for example, the WWF buying out WCW's licensing agent to the tune of about $1 million. So you can read about how all that shaked out. But the important thing to note, as you talked about there, is that wasn't the extent of the WWF's financial outlay. So if we go back to that $2.5 million figure, which represents the cash portion of the transaction, the total costs paid by the WWF were actually something close to, more than that by, it exceeded that by a factor of 10, okay? Because part of that asset purchase agreement, which was entered into by the WWF and TBS on March 29th, 2001, you can read about the terms of it in the book, made note of an advertising commitment that would play out over a period of 3 years, where the WWF committed to spending money to advertise on properties that were owned by AOL Time Warner to the tune of $20.6 million, okay, between the years of 2001 and 2004. So you might say, well, why wasn't that just rolled into the deal up front? Why this elaborate deal structure? Why not just, if overall AOL is going to be receiving from the WWF, if we're talking in the neighborhood of about 25 million here, let's sort of round down to that number to make it easy. If we're talking about 25 million as opposed to $2.5 million, why not just structure the deal in such a way where that could be received up front, right? And I posed that question to Stuart Snyder, who was responsible for sort of commandeering the transaction from the WWF standpoint, and he responded to that. He sort of made mention that if the deal was structured in that way, I'm not sure we would have actually gone for it at that particular time. But if you think about it, selling this albatross, this money pit, WCW, for $25 million, a company that, our understanding is that it had lost $62 million in the previous year, probably would have raised some questions like who's going to pay $25 million for a company that doesn't have television, a company that has all of these guys still under long-term contracts, right? Whether they be Goldberg, Lex Luger, Kevin Nash, Sting. I mean, Goldberg alone was owed $6.6 million at the time of the deal. Who's going to pay $25 million for a company with those liabilities that doesn't have television and just lost $62 million in the year 2000, which is a very good question, which we talk about in a lot of detail in the chapter. So hopefully that kind of makes sense. I mean, I'm covering like a lot of ground there. And if people, really want to get the nitty-gritty of
Read
that,
the
again, I
book.
just
Read the book.
encourage you to read the book. But
Yes, yes, yes.
does that make sense to you, Josh? I just want to be sure.
Can you repeat the whole thing again? No, I'm just kidding.
Okay, let's from the top.
From the top, from the top. No, I think it does. I think when people read it, they're going to get a much, I wouldn't say a much better sense, but they're going to get some of the, they have the kind of the big rock of the information we just shared. And but they're going to get the reasons why. And I think that's one of the things where, again, the first book and this book is so detailed is that you and I can talk about the big thing. But then it's also, well, how'd you get there? And if people are like want to understand, like, well, how did they get there? That is in there and then some in all these cases. And that's throughout the book. So yeah, I think if people want to be more educated on this and get have some more historical perspective and so on, I think it's more invaluable. And I do want to point out, these are just two chapters in a much bigger book. You went over kind of the different sections being in time. I want to make sure we have enough time for the Hogan Kickstarter. I want to talk about that in a minute. But I do want to bring up two aspects. One is Keith Mitchell, who you mentioned earlier in this in our talk today, and someone that when it's so interesting when it comes to the production of wrestling and the higher ups put him off to the side. But people talk so much about Kevin Dunn, and for better or worse, his influence in how wrestling is seen and so on. And it's interesting that Keith Mitchell is a name that for people that are into this stuff that they know, but I don't. And I think the chapter on him does a really great job of kind of illustrating just how influential he was, not just to WCW, but I mean TNA, AEW. He's doing stuff still, even in retirement. Red River Pete is doing stuff for Maple Leaf Pro and every. And I think it just it, it an unsung hero. I don't know if that's the right way of putting it, but just someone I think maybe just underappreciated in just how influential he was and has been to the business. And no one that you would say like he doesn't do like. I think this is mentioned in the chapter, not a lot of podcast appearances or anything like this. He could be on one of these Conrad podcasts with Tony Schiavone or something, just telling stories and people would be absolutely enthralled by it. But someone that I think is has been so influential in the business, but has done so, I don't know, in shadows is the right way of putting it, but he's not as much as a well-known, perhaps reviled figure as Kevin Dunn is, put it that way.
Yeah, that's right. And what was interesting in talking to Keith is that this all stems from, as he tells it, an interaction he had with John Stossel, who was obviously in the midst of doing that infamous expose on the business back in the 80s. And he
Yes,
recalls
yes.
getting a call from Stossel and, oh no, we just want to shine a light on the business and we want to show people the great work that you do and so forth. And, the way that Keith sort of relayed that to me was, he kind of said, okay, I guess we'll provide them with some footage and, answer their questions, only to report this to Fritz von Erich, who basically said, you're not going to be talking to this person any further. This is an expose, this is a setup. And I think the penny kind of dropped there as to perhaps what the intent was and what the relationship was between the media and the wrestling business, especially at that time. So following that, as you talked about, Keith basically kept the lowest profile of probably almost anyone with his level of influence that I can think of over that time frame. He did do one podcast interview with Chris Jericho upon leaving AEW at the end of 2021, where they talked about, different aspects of his career. But other than that, he hasn't granted an interview in print or on the internet and so forth. But I mean, you talk about someone with, so many stories to tell over the decades, and someone who's been so close to, many, many important occurrences in the wrestling business, and someone who is, almost, without exception, respected by any and everyone who came in contact with him. I mean, when you mention the name Keith Mitchell to anyone, whether it be at AEW, WCW, TNA, World Class, I mean, nothing but the utmost respect, nothing but admiration, not only for his talents, but the thing that I often heard from people was the fact that he couldn't be fazed. No matter what craziness was going on, and God knows there was a lot of it at WCW, the guy was always able to maintain a cool hand and was able to direct the ship, in a very steady fashion. Even dealing with things like we talk about in the chapter, where they lost power during a live Nitro broadcast and things like that. Everyone's freaking out, everyone's running around like headless chickens, and he's just, very calmly directing matters from the production truck and going through the options in his head of what they could do. So he was someone that was absolutely had the right temperament for who you need in that position. And I was very pleased to see how open and transparent he was, given the fact that he hadn't really done any interviews before. I mean, he was very much, unfiltered and honest with talking about some of the good times and obviously a lot of the bad times as well. One of the things that stands out to me is, he talks about the aftermath of the infamous Bash at the Beach 2000 episode with, Hogan and Vince Russo, obviously, and Eric Bischoff, obviously, being part of that. And he talks about a conversation he had with, Brad Siegel, in terms of a decision that had to be made related to that episode, and the fact that the Siegel did not want to make a decision and would basically, come up with every excuse under the sun to sort of deflect responsibility from himself in that regard. And as Keith kind of explained it, this was just the continuation of a lot of people that he had to deal with at Turner and also WCW, in that, they were often in a position where they had to fly by the seat of their pants. They had to make adjustments on the fly. And it's kind of amazing, as he tells it, that while this whole thing was going down and Vince Russo is in the ring lambasting Hulk Hogan, Keith is in the production truck. No one's told him about this. He has absolutely no idea what's going on. He doesn't know, should I cut the guy's mic? Should we cut to a video package? Do I let this play out? And he's not able to get an answer from anyone. He's having to sit there on a live pay-per-view and make that determination on his own. So kind of an incredible story, and it's just one of many things that he talked about. So I'm glad you brought that up, because Keith is, again, really a towering figure when it comes to the last 4 decades in the wrestling business, particularly on the production end. And if you talk to anyone who's worked with him, I mean, they just sing the guy's praises to no end. So I was really glad to speak with him for this.
Good. And I will point, I want people to read the books. I don't want to go too deep in this, but the Ralph Sheehan story, Dusty's Trucks, that was one. I think it's one of the main reasons I'm glad these books exist, is because how else are you going to get that story? And basically, it's a story about, I'll just paraphrase, I want people to read it. A story of a motorsport show that decided to be turned to a hybrid wrestling show, and everything that happened because of that. And Dusty Rhodes was a big part of it. And it's just one of these stories told by this guy who clearly he understood wrestling, but he wasn't like a huge fan. And he is just, it's always kind of what we talk about from people outside the business, right? And that people that don't follow wrestling, if all of a sudden they're dropped in and they're like, here's what's going to happen. And they're seeing this and they're like, what is going on? Right? Like, it is just, and just, but he's also having like a ton of fun with this. So I suggest that, but that's one of the reasons, again, I'm glad these books exist, is it tells these stories that otherwise, like, how is anyone going to remember or even know that this motorsports announcer, who probably none of us have really heard, no offense to him, because that's not, unless you earn that business or follow that business, you may not have never heard of him. How else are we going to get these stories about him, Dusty Rhodes, and this very strange season of the TV show?
That's right. And what Josh is talking about there is this infamous Motor Madness program, which aired on TNN, which actually started as kind of a straight, racing show, for lack of a better term. It was just, regular coverage of these different kind of off the wall
Dune
events that
buggies.
pertain. Yeah, exactly. That pertain to motorsports. But, at some point, the decision was made at the level of the network, to capitalize on the growing popularity of wrestling, during that time. So they came up with this very unique fusion, idea of combining motorsports with some of the, tropes associated with professional wrestling. It wasn't like they had a ring. It wasn't like there were matches or anything like that. But they basically took all of the campy, elements of wrestling at that time and rolled them into the show. And so all of a sudden, Ralph Sheheen goes from being, he's this decorated motorsports announcer. He's, given this job, and like I said, as far as he's concerned, we're calling this thing straight up. And then, the next thing he knows, he gets told, well, now it's turning into a hybrid motorsports wrestling show. Here's this guy, Dusty Rhodes, who's going to be working with you at the announce table, and here's a 62-page script. So instead of having a list or a format of the different events that are going to occur, now we need you to follow this script where we're going to cut from, an event to some sort of quote unquote wrestling storyline. And then we're going to go back to the event, and then we're going to go back to the storyline, and Dusty's going to help you string it all together. So there's still a lot of footage that exists on YouTube if you want to type in TNN Motor Madness. But to your point, speaking with someone like that and hearing, yes, prior to that, he wasn't really the most aware person when it came to the wrestling business and what was going on. But the level of respect that he exited that experience with, particularly in regards to Dusty, and the fact that the guy could make anything work, that the fact that on the fly they had to make sense of this quote unquote storyline, which by the way was never resolved, and still call this thing when necessary as straight as can be. He just marveled at, like, the ability that someone like that could have, and basically said, I don't know how these guys do it. So I like telling stories like that that shine a positive light on the wrestling business. I mean, there's so much, I don't want to say negativity, but there's just so much, derision, and there's so many sort of obvious elements that we could talk about some of the more unsavory aspects of it. But one of the things that's always stood out to me is the fact that almost we take for granted how special some of these guys are, being able to go out in front of a live audience where there's no opportunity for a do-over, and the way that they're able to adjust on the fly, the way they're able to respond to the feedback that they're getting and make things work. And so I like telling stories like that. And obviously Dusty is someone that whenever you have a Dusty story, it could be a story of Dusty going to the supermarket, right? It's going to be entertaining because Dusty's in it.
Exactly. I think you make a good point. It wasn't all bad, and it wasn't all bad people that ran it or that were involved. And with any story, especially in big business, there's a lot of details that sometimes get lost and not unearthed, which these books, Nitro and of course Beyond Nitro, do, which you can pick up, of course, on Amazon, the Guy Evans Books, GuyEvansBooks.com, or wherever you buy your books. And if you have any questions, you can reach out to Guy on social media and so on. So before we go, I will point out this interview was originally planned to be, I think, about a week ago or so, but it's actually, serendipitous it happened today, because between then, Guy, you announced a new project, hopeful new project. A Kickstarter. You can search by searching Hulk Hogan book Kickstarter in the Google machine. And you are looking to write not one, not two, but three books on somebody, three full-length books, Guy, on someone that everyone knows around the world. Hulk Hogan. You were looking to write a biographical trilogy on Hulk Hogan. And I mean, I don't know how long this is going to take you to do, but tell us about this, the idea, when you thought of it, and the floor is yours. Let's hear about this.
Yeah, I appreciate you giving me time to talk about that. So yeah, this is something that we announced about a week ago, and there's been, the reaction to this, just the sheer announcement, is something that's kind of taken me aback as well. But it's something I'm really excited about. After finishing Beyond Nitro, I started to think about what could come next, because obviously, I think as we've mentioned before, that Nitro book, I envisioned it as being like my one contribution to wrestling literature, if you like. I'm going to write this one book, and that'll be the end of it. But obviously, it's snowballed into leading to a bunch of other things, including helping other people with their autobiographies and so forth. But one of the things that I haven't done to date is actually do a biography of someone. And I was sort of considering a few different names, and Hulk Hogan was one of them. So after doing the bulk of the writing for Beyond Nitro, I started to, do some basic research and talk to some people who are close to Hulk about getting an idea of potentially what this book could look like. But in all honesty, after he passed away, which, although pretty much everyone listening to this obviously had an awareness that something was up. We knew of the health issues. We were hearing the rumors. We were hearing certain people saying it's much more serious than advertised. But even with that being said, I think it's safe to say kind of took everyone aback that the guy actually passed away this summer. And after looking at the response to his death, both positive and negative, you know, people who chose to remember some of the ways that perhaps he inspired them in their life, or what Hulkamania may have represented at one particular point in time, or people who appreciated his talent, and equally people who, you know, raised the obvious, you know, controversial, and in some cases just purely very negative facets of his personality. Looking at all of that in its totality, I realized that, you know, one book on Hulk Hogan would really be doing this guy, not doing this guy justice. It would be selling him short. You know, if ever there was a person that deserved the kind of treatment that you often see in the genre of biography more generally, if we take a step outside of wrestling for a second, you know, you'll see that there are these historical figures that quite frequently receive this kind of treatment where they receive a series of books. I thought if ever there was someone deserving of that, it would be Hulk Hogan, both for good reasons and for bad reasons. And so once I reached that realization that there's, you know, let's take the original Nitro book, for example, you know, that's nearly 600 pages. And we're only looking at really a 5.5 year time span. So I started looking at the longevity that this guy had in the public eye and saying, okay, there's no way that this can be anything less than a trilogy. And once I reached that realization, I thought it might be a good idea to try to partner with as many people as possible who are interested in making this happen. Because in full transparency, what this will mean, as you talked about, Josh, is a massive, massive time investment. There's going to be, you know, just a tremendous amount of effort that's going to go into this. And it's going to, you know, quite naturally result in some things that I had planned to do, you know, won't be happening. Other things might have to be put on the back burner. You know, there are certain people that either I, you know, sort of have an agreement to work with, or we're very close to that I may have to say it's going to have to wait for a little bit longer. So so we came up with the idea of doing a Kickstarter, and right now we're in sort of the pre-launch phase. But it's really essential, if you're interested in this, to sign up to be notified when the project actually goes live, which should be very, very soon. We're thinking at the very latest it'll be the end of this month. So we're really talking a couple of weeks away. But if you go on Kickstarter and type in the Hulk Hogan story, or just Hulk Hogan, it should be the first thing that pops up. And that's the best way to make sure, you know, that you get notified when it actually goes up. Because look, we all have a million things competing for our attention. There's a million things we're trying to keep straight in our heads at any given time. That's the best way to make sure that you don't have to worry about that. You can just get the email and you can support the campaign. And I do just want to mention that this is totally independent. There's no association or relationship whatsoever. And I'm only mentioning this because this was asked to me recently, you know, between myself and like the Balea family or the estate or anything like that. This is a totally independent project. If you, you know, appreciated the way that I've treated the WCW story, and I think the objectivity of that and the fairness that I would like to think that I displayed towards that story, you can expect exactly the same thing here. You know, I think I kind of have a somewhat of an advantage, I would like to think, in that, you know, I didn't have a personal relationship with Terry Bollea or Hulk Hogan. You know, there were many times over the past few years, especially, you know, I'm sure that if I would have said to certain people, hey, I'd like to spend some time with the guy, I'd like to meet the guy, I'd like to interview him or something, you know, that could have happened. Obviously, you know, it never did. But in some sense, I think that you know, adds to the fact that, and even if that was the case, I mean, I think my sort of writing style and approach would be the same. But I think, you know, I kind of have that going for us in this regard. The fact that I'm based in Tampa also helps in terms of being able to visit some of these, you know, important sites relative to his childhood and his upbringing. And of course, speak to so many people in the area that grew up with the guy, worked with the guy, saw the whole rise, saw the Hulkamania era from that standpoint. So I think we have the potential here to produce something that is, you know, unprecedented in the genre of wrestling biographies, but it's going to take, you know, the support from everyone listening to make this possible. But I think we can do it. And, you know, as Josh said, we're not just looking at one mammoth book. We're looking at three, and I'm not sure if they're going to be able to get that through your mailbox, but it'll certainly keep you busy for a long time. And I'm determined to, like I do with all of my books, bring to light as much new information and perspectives and unexpected twists and turns as the other books have. And I'm fully confident, purely based on what I have so far, that you're going to see that play out here as well.
That's right. Yeah, if anything, like these other books you've done, very detailed, and at this point, people know what to get from your books, and I think that if they're looking for the true life and times of Hulk Hogan, I think they're going to get that and then some with these three. Of course, you can go to Kickstarter, as Guy mentioned, search for Hulk Hogan book. So Google Kickstarter Hulk Hogan book, Guy social media as well. You can see the links there. And if I mean, look, if you have some money. $500 toward this Kickstarter. You get to have lunch with
Come
Guy
on.
Evans at Hogan's
What more could you
Hangout
want?
in Clearwater, Florida. How about that? Of course, and then you get the books as well. Not just that, but yeah, that would be a lunch with Guy Evans. How about that? At Hogan's
Mean, come
Hangout.
on. Who could say no to that?
I
No, I'm kidding.
know, I know. That'd be tremendous. But yeah, you can check all that as well. And of course, as I mentioned at the onset, the other books, which include Nitro, the original, Beyond Nitro, Grateful, a book with Eric Bischoff, Sitting Ringside, Volume 1 and 2, of course, The Life and Times of the still very alive Dave Penzer, written with Guy Evans. And then, yeah, of course, you can get all that as on Amazon, GuyEvansBooks.com, and anywhere else you want to send people, social media, websites, anything like that, anything I leave out.
No, I just appreciate the time, Josh, and I thank you for, giving me the time to talk about the Kickstarter as well. As you mentioned, GuyEvansBooks.com or Amazon, you can go and check out all of the books that you mentioned, the Kickstarter page, the Hulk Hogan story. That's kind of the working title. I mean, we'll see how things evolve, but that's kind of where we're starting at this point. And if you'd like to, follow me on X, the account is Guy Evans Books. So that will give you updates, obviously, on this upcoming campaign and a lot of other stuff that is planned for 2026 as well. So just want to thank you again, Josh, and thank everyone for listening.
Other stuff, guy. I mean, how many more things can you fit on this calendar? I mean, I know there's 24 hours in a day, but boy, there's a lot of stuff.
Well, listen, hey, you know what happens is it's you do one thing and naturally it sort of leads to other things. You get introduced to other people approach you, and I'm just grateful for all of it. I try to keep in mind that when opportunities come about, you want to try to take them, and I'm as I think I may have talked about in the Kickstarter page. I do feel, a certain obligation as well, and a certain sense of loyalty, a true sense of loyalty to all of the people that have supported these books, because there hasn't been any marketing budget. There's been no grand master plan of how we're going to make everyone aware of it. It's purely because of people like yourself having me on, and then the readers, recommending the books to other people that it's been able to grow the way it has. So, I'm always the number one thing in my mind whenever I sit down to do any of this stuff is understanding that people have an innumerable number of things they could be spending their time on. And I want to make sure that if you're purchasing one of these books, you're going to take away tons of new stuff. It's going to be well worth your time. And equally, that you can go back and reread, these things at your leisure as well. So, I really want to do this to give the wrestling fans something that hopefully will stand apart and be befitting of Hulk Hogan's legacy again for the good reasons and the bad reasons as well.
I forgot one more question before I let you go. I know I've had you for a while. Is this going to be the farewell to the Nitro series at this point? You think you've kind of emptied out the chest, so to speak?
Well, it's difficult to answer that because if I was to look at sort of the pile of notes and folders that I'm taking a look at right now in my office, I know that that isn't the case. I know that there's, believe it or not, there's still some other facets and aspects to this that I can get into. We'll see how that shakes out. It would in one sense kind of make sense to do a third and final book to kind of round out that series. And I'm sort of playing with some ideas there, but equally, I think people will, enjoy the fact that, for example, in this prospective project that we're talking about, the Hulk Hogan project, it gives you the license, obviously, to talk about things such as the AWA, the WWF in the 80s, TNA, which I've only written about sort of sporadically, including in this new book, Beyond Nitro. So I'm excited to get into a lot of other areas of wrestling history. Even though, that sort of mid to late 90s time period is always going to resonate with me very strongly. So I think you're probably going to see a combination of the two. I do think there is certainly the potential for a third and final book there, but like I said, really excited to get into these other areas, talk to some new people and cover some new ground. But yes, if you enjoyed that Nitro book, please don't sleep on Beyond Nitro, because I'm telling you that the title is deliberate. We are really going 10 steps beyond even the analysis that was kind of present in that book, especially as it relates to the financial components. So I'm sure you'll love it.
That's right. Never say never, right? Just like wrestlers when they
There you go.
retire. You never say never with
Absolutely.
going back to the well. Guy Evans, thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Josh.